From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, a Milwaukee surgeon sees the impact of the growing rate of heart failure firsthand. Then a longtime Milwaukee journalist seeks out the inside story of the Pfister Hotel.
The Pfister down through the years has developed a reputation for not only being a hospitality center, but also a gathering place for civic initiatives and civic meetings. So I wanted to sort of go behind the scenes.
Plus, we learn about the Pfister's freaky side and an astronomical monster story for Halloween, and why Frankenstein deserves a little love.
It's easy to look back on these movies and say that they were cheesy or they were this or that and kind of reduce them, but I think that there's a magic to them that has been there for decades and decades.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Heart failure is becoming more common as our population ages. And while medicinal treatments help many heart failure patients, surgical intervention is often required as well. Dr. Robert Love is a heart transplant surgeon at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's treated scores of patients performing transplants and also mechanical implants, such as total heart replacements. We'll hear about those unique cases later in the interview. But first, he tells me why mechanical implants are on the rise as a treatment option for heart failure.
The number of heart transplants available has plateaued. And frankly, we're having fewer and fewer younger donors. We're having more and more older donors. As we get older, none of us get better for the most part, except maybe some people in Hollywood. And therefore, there's more wrong with the donors that come along. And a lot more of the hearts that are offered for transplant are simply not suitable to be transplanted. So the era of mechanical circulatory support is really here, and it's a good thing because, hundreds of thousands of people die every year from heart failure, and instead of heart transplant being the only alternative to medical therapy, we do have another temporizing device that can get people quality of life, longevity of life, and the ability to get a transplant.
I want to have you talk a little bit about the evolution of treating heart failure, from a surgical perspective. How has the technology improved? Where do we still need to go yet?
The story of the treatment of heart failure with mechanical devices goes back to at least the 1960s and really even into the 1930s. People like Charles Lindbergh were involved in developing an artificial heart pump. Really became possible to begin the work in the 1960s. We've gone from pumps that had to be outside the body to finally implantable pumps. The first one really started in wider use in the beginning of this decade, so in the early 2000s. So what we're heading for is increased miniaturization, I think better technology. Again, it's an unnatural thing to have a man-made device inside your heart. So there are certain limitations that we run up against just because we're not replacing the tissue failure with an organ that actually works, which would be the ideal. But we're making huge progress.
Tell us about the unique case of Kathleen Shores, who received a total heart replacement. What is that?
Right. Well, Kathleen is an individual who came in with the type of heart failure where both the right and left sides of the heart failed at the same time. So for most cases, we're treating left-sided heart failure, which the most common cause is blood vessel problems, coronary artery disease, which is very common. It's a very highly lethal disease in this country, in the Western world, and in some cases leads to heart failure. So most of the patients that come in for heart failure treatment and are treated medically or get mechanical circulatory support of some kind just need treatment of the left side. And if the left side gets better, the right side can also improve. In Kathleen's case, by the time she really got to full treatment, her disease had progressed from primarily left-sided disease to both right and left-sided disease, and she was in shock in the ICU refractory to any medical therapy, and neither the right or the left could respond to the medical therapies that we were able to offer. Additionally, she's quite small. She's a little lady. And the mechanical devices that we have are designed for bigger people. They're just still pretty bulky. We don't have an implantable device that will allow you to keep your native heart and put something in for the right side and the left side that actually is all inside the body. We do have an old device that sits outside the body where the pumps actually sit on the chest and abdomen, but people can't really go home with those things. They're very limited in their ability to exercise or not be tethered to the hospital. And then anything that sticks out of your body can get infected. And the more things that drive lines and things that come out of your body, the more chances there are for infection. So in Kathleen's case, she had to have a device that treated both the right and the left at the same time. In her case, there was only one device, and that's the total artificial heart, which is what we implanted in her in November. And that device required both the right and left sides of the heart to be removed, and then a mechanical device sewn onto the remnant of her right and left hearts and then plugged into the blood vessels leading out of each. So about as big an operation as one can do, complete removal of the heart and replacement with mechanical pumps, which is what she has.
This is some pretty amazing technology. Was this option even available a few years ago?
Well, this technology has been getting better over time. So there have been artificial hearts like this available since the 90s. The problem was that the results have been dismal. Patients have had bleeding complications. The technical abilities of these pumps to actually work reliably every heartbeat, because this is something that has to work every time. It can't decide for a couple of minutes to take a rest and recharge itself. Our ability to have the technology catch up with the need is really only recently coming to the forefront. So what Kathleen had is an unusual type of mechanical circulatory support. There are only maybe 100 people who have been home out of the hospital with the Freedom Driver in the U.S., and so she's experiencing territory that very few people have experienced.
What kind of challenge does that present to you as a surgeon as you're working with the patient?
Well, as far as the surgery goes, when you cut out somebody's heart, you can't fix it. You got to fix it with a mechanical device, and it's got to work, or the patient will die. So Kathleen, when we were done explanting the heart and basically throwing it away, there's no way to put it back, then the pump has to get sewn in. It has to get sewn in technically perfectly, and this is like plastic being sewn to human tissue. So it has a very high rate of bleeding, and in fact, Kathleen did have some bleeding episodes for which she had to go back to the operating room, and there were many days early on where it was very tough for her. She was back in the operating room for some bleeding problems because she had to be anticoagulated. You have to be fully anticoagulated. This is a pump, one for the right side, one for the left side, and it has four mechanical valves in it. And these mechanical valves, if you're not completely on anticoagulation with your blood thinned, they will clot off and the pump will fail, or clot will form inside the pump and the pump will just push the clot out to the brain or to some other organ, it'll be a disaster. So the one thing about these cases is if you're going to embark on this and the patient is going to be willing to go for it, go forward with this therapy, there's no turning back. It has to work, and you go to the operating room understanding that you're going to do something that's completely irreversible, and it has to go perfectly.
In Kathleen's case, it sounds like it went pretty much as well as one could expect given the risk of it.
Yeah, the operation went as well as could be expected. These patients who have total artificial hearts have a high rate of return to the operating room for bleeding, not just immediately within the first week, but afterwards. And I think the average experience would be patients return to the OR about 5 times for every one of these devices put in. I'm not sure how many times we've reoperated on Kathleen, but it's probably about that. So the way she looks today and feels today, she's put in a lot of hard work and been through a lot to get there. And it's nice to see her, you know, doing as well as she is this many months out, you know, approaching a year out now.
How many of these surgeries, given how rare they are, like Kathleen's with the total heart replacement, have you done personally?
This is the only total artificial heart I've done. I've done many of the other kinds of devices, but we tried to avoid using this device whenever possible and put in a left-sided device, keep the heart in place, and medically treat the right side. And if you catch patients in their course of heart failure early enough, you usually can get away with a pump on the left side and maybe a temporary pump on the right side. In her case, again, because of her size and also the fact that the right and left were equally, you know, essentially dead, they were not going to come back, this was the only choice. But this device would be really the fallback when there is nothing else that can be done and there's no other device that would work. It's a great device, but it's not something that we would be our first choice for mechanical circulatory support.
How did you even approach Kathleen with this? I would imagine as a surgeon trying to help a patient understand exactly what's going to happen, exactly what the risks are, the rarity of the surgery, that's a difficult conversation to have.
Yes, I remember that conversation pretty well up in the ICU. I mean, Kathleen was in shock, I mean, physiologic shock. So she looked gray. She couldn't think very well. She couldn't, she was much more cloudy mentally, much more anxious. She knew she was dying. I mean, she had that sense that she was dying. Over a period of about a week, our conversations went from the plan to put in a left-sided device of some sort to a plan to put in one of these temporary biventricular devices where she would have a heart pump sitting on her abdomen outside of the body but wouldn't be able to go home, to finally the total artificial heart. So the day before we did this, I came in to talk to her. We called her husband on the phone and had an initial conversation that I thought we really weren't going to be able to get by with anything short of the total artificial heart. And we had her husband come in from work, and we sat in the ICU and talked about this. And I explained to her what the difference was. And I think Kathleen got it, but her husband got it more, because they said, you know, we're going to cut your heart out and sew pumps onto the cuffs of what's left of your heart. There is no going back. There's no taking this out. The only route to fixing that problem is a new heart. And Kathleen also has some antibody levels in her bloodstream that make it difficult to find a match for the heart transplant. So that was another reason why we knew we were probably going to have mechanical circulatory support for a long time, because it would take us a while to find a heart that would match her immunologically.
In terms of this technology, because such surgeries are so rare, is it known how long a patient can survive with the total artificial heart replacement?
Well, the technology and the durability of the equipment is, you know, valves that are built to beat for 50 years without structural deterioration. We wouldn't expect that, but we would expect that these devices can go for a year to 2 years and maybe 3 years. The longest that patients have had these in are in the 2 to 3 year range. Not really by design, but because they weren't able to get transplanted for one reason or another. But it is definitely a temporary solution. Even though she's out of heart failure now and she's going shopping and enjoying her family, I mean, you can still see that she's encumbered with a lot of heavy equipment that she has to push around, and she knows every minute that she's utterly dependent on hearing the sound of that those four valves, which you can clearly hear, pushing blood through the right, then to the left, and then out to the body.
Dr. Robert Love, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me here.
Dr. Robert Love is a heart transplant surgeon at Froedtert Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. We first spoke with him in September as part of a series on heart failure. We'll take a short break now and then see two sides of Milwaukee's famed Pfister Hotel, the well-furnished and the, well, freaky. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. As we've reported on Lake Effect in the past, the number of hotels and hotel rooms in downtown Milwaukee is growing. In recent months, a new Marriott, a Hilton Garden Inn, and a new Fairfield have all opened within a few blocks of each other. But through all the changes in lodging here in the past century, one hotel has remained front and center. The Pfister Hotel is a stone's throw from the lakefront on Wisconsin Avenue. The luxury hotel is the focus of a half-hour behind-the-scenes documentary premiering on Milwaukee Public Television this evening. Host and producer Mark Segrist explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Teich why he thinks the Pfister was worth this comprehensive look.
Well, it's Milwaukee at its finest, and you know, the whole concept back at the turn of the century was to build the Pfister Hotel as a gateway to Milwaukee. And at the same time, Milwaukeeans themselves are very, very welcome in the lobby and in the conference areas and in the gathering rooms, the banquet rooms. It is Milwaukee at its finest.
There was actually another luxury hotel that existed in Milwaukee before the Pfister that sort of made the Pfister possible when it disappeared from the scene.
Absolutely. And that you're talking about the Newhall House. And the Newhall House was the scene of a tragic fire in 1883. 90 people were killed in the fire. And civic leadership immediately thereafter felt the need to build another gateway hotel. The Newhall during its day was the gateway not only to Milwaukee but to the western part of the United States, the Gate West. Civic leadership led by Guido Pfister felt that we needed to move forward not only to get past the tragedy but also to replace it as the hotel in Milwaukee. And that's how it got started.
Well, and so the idea when the Pfister family set out to build the hotel was this would be the crown jewel of places to stay?
Absolutely. And it has gone on during its 120 years to develop an international reputation. It is a luxury hotel, but it's a luxury hotel with wonderful discipline among staff. It's not just luxury service for sake of serving the rich. Those who serve in the Pfister come from the tradition of we're providing this high bar of service because it is almost an extension of our own nobility. Those who perform the service feel great about themselves in so doing it.
Well, and that was the impression one gets from watching this, that people you talk to seem to treat this as something more than just another hospitality job.
Yeah, and in the recruitment of folks who get into this line of works, luxury service, you're often told that, you know, you can be trained to do it, but it really has to come from the heart. It has to come from the soul. You really have to have an understanding and appreciation for fine service from within in order to offer it.
Where were things for the Pfister when Ben Marcus stepped in and purchased it in the 1960s?
Well, the Pfister was actually headed for a wrecking ball. And Ben Marcus purchased the Pfister in 1962. As part of, you know, his acquisition, he decided to move forward right away with building the 23-story tower addition, which is another beautiful part of the corner there. He had a long-range vision for the Pfister.
So when you flash forward to today, what does the history lead to? What should we know about where it is? I mean, it is not the only luxury hotel in the city of Milwaukee now.
Certainly not, but it has a fine tradition, and it is viewed as sort of the flagship for luxury service, hospitality in Milwaukee. Our purpose in doing it, personally, I had a great deal of intrigue about the Pfister because during the 80s when I worked for Channel 12, I covered a number of events ranging from, as you well know, a lot of baseball meetings are held there. It's the place to do business when Major League Baseball representatives come to town and when visiting teams play the Milwaukee Brewers. I covered a lot of education stories there, covered a lot of politics there. I mean, the Pfister down through the years has developed a reputation for not only being a hospitality center, but also a gathering place for civic initiatives and civic meetings. So I wanted to sort of go behind the scenes, and I wanted to appreciate what luxury service was all about and what this nobility within oneself or proviso luxury service is all about. So even before we started shooting, I spent several days in the lobby just appreciating the rhythm, the communication among staff, the setup, the breakdown, the people who are coming through the lobby. Some 2 million people come through that lobby a year. That's a phenomenal record. So I took a lot of this in, and then we started actually shooting for the half hour. And in so doing, we hopefully captured the rhythm of it. In so doing, being able to share that and help our viewership appreciate what that's all about.
And what were some of the remarkable experiences that that you think back on in the making of this? I mean, you got to go along, for example, with the people who were actually just cleaning the rooms.
Well, yeah. We spent a great deal of time with housekeeping. Claudia Vasquez is a senior housekeeper, and we were there when she was work in the halls, spend some time with her in one specific suite where she was turning it over top to bottom within 30 minutes. And she performed it as if she were a dancer or an athlete. I mean, it's a remarkable talent, the folks who work on the front line of luxury service. She rolls in with her cart. She's running the water in the bathroom and the sauna at the same time. She's turning over the bed at the same time she's dusting. It's almost like watching an artist multitask and, go about their project. It's a very artful, almost like, as I said, almost like a dance. It's remarkable talent. The staff, led by Annie Fang, director of housekeeping, turns that hotel over top to bottom every day. It's remarkable. It's a remarkable talent.
So have you ever stayed at the Pfister yourself?
I've never stayed at the Pfister, but I've seen a great deal of the Pfister. And there's an interesting backstory. I've even seen the catacombs of the Pfister.
How did that happen?
Keep in mind, we were spending a great deal of time shooting and illustrating and explaining one of the finest hotels in the world, super luxury service, right? We asked one of the doormen during our production if he wouldn't mind wearing a wireless microphone so that we could capture him interacting with guests as they were pulling up, checking in, et cetera, et cetera. Everything was going great. My good friend Michael Garvin was getting some great sound, some great footage of the doorman at work interacting with guests. And I decided, as all good reporters do at one time during the shooting process, I better get myself out of the way of Michael's shot. So I decided to go right up against the wall, exterior wall of Pfister, get out of the way, be a good guy. A flock of seagulls flies over, and I'm not paying a great deal of attention to it because I'm pretty interested in what Michael's shooting. All of a sudden, it sounds like it's raining, and I'm thinking, what in the heck is that? And I look at my dark blue suit, and suddenly I'm covered. It's almost like a bunch of folks opened up bottles of Whiteout, in the old typewriter days. I'm covered from head to toe with just these white blotches of stuff on my new blue suit.
This is a occupational hazard in downtown Milwaukee.
This is like midday. I still have a great deal of on-camera work to do with guests, okay? And I don't know what to do. So they look at me and they said, well, before we go any further, you better do something. So I make this long trek into the lobby towards the men's room. Mitch, I felt like I was walking 30 miles. People are looking at me like, who is this person? I felt like such a railroad hobo. I make it to the men's room. I meet Omar Naimi, who is the director of operations. And Omar says, look, I'll take you into housekeeping. You look a mess. All of a sudden, he opens up this door, and I'm seeing a whole different side of the Pfister. It is truly the catacombs of housekeeping, because they can get anywhere in this great tunnel system. They start throwing towels at me, wipe me down. I'm so embarrassed. I go back out in the lobby. People are looking at me like, well, that's an improvement. Go about the rest of our shoot. And we put it to bed for the day, but it was such a humiliating experience.
Is there anything we should look for in particular in any of those shots?
When you're in downtown Milwaukee about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, say like the month of June, always look skyward if you feel like it's raining.
Bring an umbrella.
Absolutely.
Mark Segrist, it's a fun documentary. Thanks for sharing the story of it and that that fairly difficult story of it as well.
Yes. Always a pleasure to be with you, my friend.
Mark Segrist is the host and producer of Inside the Pfister, a Milwaukee icon. The half-hour documentary premieres tonight at 7:30 on Milwaukee Public Television. Segrist spoke with Mitch Tyke. You'll find a link to an excerpt from the show at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The Pfister is known for a lot of things. Its luxury service, its artist-in-residence, the fine dining it offers, and also its reputation for haunting visiting sports teams. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke first brought us this story a couple of years ago. Our story starts at Miller Park, where Mitch met up with outfielder Carlos Gomez, who had recently joined the Brewers.
It was a Friday afternoon in June, and Gomez was then playing for the Minnesota Twins. The Twins, like many visiting Major League teams, stayed at the Pfister Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. The game wasn't until that night, and Gomez had just woken up from a nap when he noticed something was a little off about his room. First, he says the lights he had left on were now off, and the lights he had left off had been turned on. But there was more.
And I stopped putting my clothes, I put on my underwear, and I leave my iPod in the bed. And my iPod started changing the music by itself. I hear kind of noise, like they change the music. And I go touch, and before that I touch, they stop. And when I back out to a step back, they start again. I come back, touch, they start. And I'm taking my shoes and my pants, and I be in no t-shirt. I'm running my room and on the wear. I put on my pants and my shirt in the lobby.
Yes, if you were in the lobby of the Pfister Hotel that day, that was a Major League Baseball player you saw in his underwear before he grabbed a cab and headed for Miller Park. So, okay, in the grand scheme of things, lighting changes and a rogue iPod don't rank up there with the spookiest scenes in The Exorcist or the most chilling scenes in Poltergeist. But the experience shook Carlos Gomez enough that he confided about it to his first base coach, who was sufficiently creeped out that he slept that night with the lights on and the curtains open. And the next time the Twins came back to Milwaukee...
And I can't sleep, you know. And last year we come here to the four-game series, and I stay all night long in the lobby.
So for Gomez, the best part of his trade to the Brewers may not have been the promise of a starting outfield job, but knowing he no longer had to stay at the Pfister. But there are plenty of unfortunate major leaguers who have not had the good luck to end up in a Brewers uniform and are still subject to the supernatural goings-on at the Pfister. Mickey Bradley and his colleague Dan Gordon have compiled many of their stories in the book Field of Screams, which devotes an entire chapter to the haunted hotel.
You started hearing about the same places over and over, certain fields that they said were haunted and certain hotels. And one of the hotels that we heard about repeatedly was the Pfister in Milwaukee. Lots of guys either had stories there themselves, they said, or knew of other things that had happened to other ballplayers.
And Bradley points out that these are not just bench players looking to get some notoriety any way they can.
All right, Lincecum is one of my favorites.
That's Tim Lincecum, who you might already know from winning two straight Cy Young Awards.
At about 4 in the morning, he said he heard a knocking on his door, a pressing on his door, and he just refused to open the door. He flipped the latch on it, and he sort of retreated to the bed and turned on the lights to sleep with the lights on for the rest of the night because he wasn't going to go near that door.
In fact, several players in this year's World Series say they've had ghostly encounters at the Pfister. Colby Lewis, tonight's expected starter for the Rangers, reportedly saw an apparition in his room when he visited this summer. And Texas catcher Matt Traynor was with the Florida Marlins when he and a teammate heard knocking on the wall. Writer Mickey Bradley describes what came next.
A few moments later, they heard the screaming of a child. And this is something that people report in the Pfister on a regular basis. They hear a young child, Traynor said he thought about 6 or 7 years old, screaming in the hallway. They opened the door. There's nobody there.
Unlike his cowering colleagues, though, Traynor sought out the ghost his next time through Milwaukee, leading his friends on a late night and unfruitful ghost hunt through the Pfister's hallways. All right, so what is going on at the Pfister? The Rangers' C.J. Wilson set the scene to ESPN Radio in Dallas shortly after he had his own frightening night there.
It's creepy, straight up. It's like something out of, you know, like Eastern Europe or whatever, stylistically.
15-game winner and architectural historian C.J. Wilson aside, the Pfister is maybe described better as old world. The building itself was built before the turn of the century, the last century, in the Romanesque Revival style. Victorian artwork hangs from the walls of an ornate grand lobby, and a real live piano player accompanies the less-than-spooky business lunches going on at the restaurant. Joe Kurth is the hotel's general manager.
I have heard so many stories about the spirit of hospitality within the Pfister.
That is partly marketing speak, but it's also history.
The iconic feeling of the lobby, the grand staircases you walk in, there have been suggestions that Charles Pfister, that grand iconic gentleman at the turn of the century, occasionally stops by to check on the well-being of his guests.
Kurth has been at the hotel for 3 years and says he has not experienced ghosts, either of a benevolent or a mischievous nature, but he's heard the stories ballplayers have told. And so has Allison Jornlin, who runs the website MilwaukeeGhosts.com. and she's not convinced that Charlie Pfister is the ghost playing with lights and iPods of ballplayers.
Certainly, they're not experiencing that same kind-hearted ghost that is seen overseeing the hospitality of his hotel. It seems like they're actually getting more of a prankster entity that is giving them a hard time.
Chornlund says all the stories from ballplayers make a pretty persuasive case for, well, something. But she's calling for players like C.J. Wilson, Adrian Beltre, and Tim Lincecum to go one step further for the cause of science.
It's really important, if something is really going on here, that the team members who've had experiences understand, you know, how important their experiences are to people who are serious investigators in the paranormal field.
She says investigators would ask fact-based questions like exact times and locations, and more philosophical ones like whether baseball players are being targeted specifically. If that's the case, someone with a higher authority would have to order such an investigation. And as we stand in front of the Pfister Hotel, the full moon rises over the office of the baseball commissioner right across the street. A call to Bud Selig's office went unreturned. For Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke in Milwaukee.
Mitch Tyke first produced that story on the haunted Pfister 2 years ago. Coming up next, we learn what things go bump in the sky from our astronomy contributor. Next on Lake Effect from WUWM. The Halloween edition of Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. There are plenty of scary things we might see in the sky on this holiday. Witches, bats, spooky apparitions, or maybe even a comet. Well, the comet isn't here yet, but our ancestors certainly believed them to be spooky. Lake Effect astronomy contributor Gene Creighton talked with Mitch Tyke about some monsters in the sky and the approach of Comet Ison.
This comet could be one of these really brilliant comets that becomes a naked eye object. In other words, you don't need a telescope to see it. Or, of course, it could fizzle because it is what we call a sun-grazing comet. And that means that it comes very close to the sun. And, of course, if something fragile and frozen comes that close to the sun, it has a very good chance of not surviving that trip. So we don't know that, of course, at this time. What we do know is that its closest approach is going to be on November 28th, and then it's going to get closest to the Earth around Christmas time, actually. What makes this comet particularly amusing is that it's from the Oort cloud. So there are two types of comets, what we call the short period comet. If the period of a comet is less than 200 years, then we call it a short period comet. If it's more than that, but it can be 10,000 years periods, then that would be a long period comet.
So Halley's Comet is an example of a short period comet?
That's right. But this one comes from the Oort cloud, and the Oort cloud is much farther out than the Kuiper Belt where most of these other short period comets come from. So based on how this one is acting, and we got some really nice images in early October with the Hubble Space Telescope, we think this is its first pass toward the sun. It comes at a very highly inclined orbit. We think it hasn't done it again. It probably got shuffled because these frozen things are sitting there at the edges of our solar system. But if the star cruises by, it can disturb them and it can send them toward the big gravitational player in the center of our solar system. So this, as I said, could be spectacular because it will have released a very large amount of material. So frozen material will turn into gas and that can create those glorious tails, of course, that we get to see.
Well, and there was a time when comets were really seen as scary. They were harbingers of doom, if you will.
Yes, they were, because they were unpredictable. And I guess it makes sense. Ancient people studied the skies a lot, and they understood all the cycles, and they took comfort, I think, in knowing that all the stars are going to rise at the right time every day. They worked very hard to predict planets, which are not as easy to predict as stars are. But then there were things that happened that were completely unexpected, and that did scare them. Eclipses scared them. Eventually, they got better at predicting those because they saw patterns. But in the case of a comet, you really don't have enough data points to say this is really happening every 2,000 years.
Well, we probably don't need to remind anyone that this is Halloween, and one of the iconic images of Halloween is a spooky full moon with a witch or maybe a bat in silhouette. The phases of the moon are not going to cooperate for that this year, but that does not mean that there are not also monsters in the sky to talk about.
Of course. We can always rely on the royal family. This time of year, we can see Cassiopeia, the queen. She looks like an M or a W, and she is in her glory right now because she's on the other side of the North Star with respect to the Big Dipper. And the Big Dipper is at its lowest point in the sky. It's grazing the northern horizon, whereas the lovely queen is way up high. Now, the reason why I think of her when I think of monsters is because she is connected to the story of Medusa. And she is a bona fide monster. Of course, she was the lady who had the snaky hair. And if you looked at her, of course, you turned into stone. From an astronomical point of view, it's interesting that many cultures associated that part of the sky that we call Perseus in modern astronomy with something unfortunate because one of its bright stars, called Algol, is in fact a variable star. Some stars are variable because they really are going through issues in their career, and indeed they're going through a bit of a midlife crisis and changing their brightness. But in this case, Algol has a very predictable pattern of changes in brightness because it's a binary system. When you can see both stars, you get the maximum brightness, but if one covers the other, then you get reduction in the whole brightness. If we consider, again, the predictability that ancient people liked, they didn't like that. They liked stars to be good and steady, and if they changed so dramatically, they thought that was bad news. So Perseus in the sky is holding the head of Medusa, and the eye of Medusa is this Algol, this variable star. Medusa was killed by Perseus, and that's why he's holding her head. Perseus is the offspring of Vanai. So Vanai was the daughter of a queen and a king, and the king was told that his grandson is going to kill him. So he's going to close his daughter, Vanai, in a prison, and she will never get to meet anybody, and that'll settle that problem. But of course, he underestimated Zeus, who wasn't going to let a little prison get in his way. And I think he wins here the award for the best disguise of all. He turned himself into golden rain. And that's how he entered the prison. And of course, they did have a baby together, Perseus. The king was obviously upset, but he knew that it would be unwise to kill the son of Zeus. So he launched them off into a little vessel and hoped that they would perish at sea, but they didn't. And they ended up landing on the island of Seriphos, and they were picked up by Polydectes, the king of that island. And he took a look at Danae and thought, very nice. So he waited until her son got a little older and sent him off on a mission because he, of course, wanted to get the kid out of the way so he could woo Vanai. And the mission was, of course, to kill Medusa. Perseus was a young man and somewhat reckless and didn't realize that that was a very dangerous task. And left to his own devices, there was no way that he could possibly succeed. But the goddess Athena, who had a soft spot for heroes in need of help and wisdom, advised him that he needed to get some magical items, including the winged sandals of Hermes, of Mercury, and also an invisible helmet that he could wear so he could make himself invisible, a few other items, a diamond sword, so that he could catch Medusa by surprise, get her head, put it in a magical sack, and he in fact managed to do the job. And as he was flying back home to get his mother out of this tight spot, because he understood correctly that his mother didn't really want to marry the king of Seriphos, lo and behold, he sees a princess on a rock. Now this is the princess Andromeda, who's also a constellation in the sky, and She realizes that she has to sacrifice herself because her mother, Cassiopeia, the M or W that I said before, had made a very foolish claim, said that she was the most beautiful of all women. The Greek goddesses said, well, if you're going to be like that, we'll send a terrible monster, and you'll have to sacrifice your own daughter to the monster. Perseus isn't going to let a young woman being eaten by a monster there, so he does, in fact, kill the monster as well, and marries the lovely princess.
What a perfect monsters and heroes story for Halloween.
And
remind us where we can see the royal family in the sky.
You would see it in the northeast in the early evening. So not only can we see Cassiopeia, we can see Andromeda. Andromeda is a little hard to find just because she has the shape of the letter V, a little curvy. But the good thing is that it's off the square of Pegasus. Pegasus is nice and high in the east, southeast, depending on the time that you look up. And Andromeda is going to be beautifully attached to that square.
And also keep a lookout for the Eye of Medusa. And if we can't see it, we should not be concerned that it is a harbinger of bad things to come.
No. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Thanks, Jean.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and she's our regular astronomy contributor. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. One last break, and when we return, two writers craft a tale that's truly fit for a Frankenstein. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of a Halloween Lake Effect now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Many of us grew up idolizing superheroes. Some of us still do. But for writers Paul McComas and Greg Starrett, it was the characters that populated Universal Pictures' creature features of the 1930s and 40s that caught their imaginations. From Wolfman to Frankenstein's monster, the pair found a kinship with these antiheroes and with each other. After a young Greg joined a young Paul's Lon Chaney Jr. fan club, the pen pals turned into lifelong friends. Decades later, the pair have joined forces to pay tribute to the films that entertained them for so long. But they also set out to fix a small logistical flaw in a Frankenstein flick that only the most ardent fans would have noticed. How exactly did Frankenstein get his fancy new suit? The answer is found in the duo's new novella, Fit for a Frankenstein, a tale about a tailor's chance encounter with the monster and his buddy Igor. McComas joined me in the studio, with Starrett joining by phone from Munster, Indiana, and McComas explains why he first fell in love with these original genre films.
The beautiful black and white cinematography, you know, this is where we get the term silver screen, and those movies from the 30s and 40s had all these shades of gray, and some of them really luminous. Many of these films were made in part by German expatriates who had left as the Reich was taking power and came to Hollywood and did amazing work within genre movies of the 30s and 40s. The actors, you know, people like Boris Karloff, Colin Clive, Elsa Lancaster, Bela Lugosi, who, you know, we sort of star him in his portrayal of Igor in our novella. And, you know, it's easy to look back on these movies and say that they were cheesy or they were this or that and kind of reduce them. But I think that there's a magic to them that has been there for decades and decades since the people making them brought them to light.
And what about you, Greg?
You know, some kids were into superheroes, and monsters just seemed like kind of those things to me when I was a kid. The Frankenstein monster in particular, you know, strong, indestructible, and just he had, I mean, basically they had superpowers, these monsters, the Wolfman, Dracula. And, you know, all the things Paul said certainly apply as well. They're beautifully made movies. They're beautiful looking, great scores. But as a kid, I think it was akin to being the superhero thing, with these monsters had superpowers. And I wasn't afraid of them. I felt a kinship to them and thought of them as, like, heroes kind of a thing. Universal always made the monsters, they weren't just these unfeeling, killing monsters. There was always a sympathy right. level there that appealed to me as a kid.
Right. They were wounded in some way. The monster was terribly sad and lonely and rejected by everyone whose path he crossed. And that's part of the reason why he turned out murderous. The Wolfman had this other side, the tormented, accidental killer. You know, he didn't ask for that curse. In fact, it came to him as a result of a good deed. He tried to defend someone and he got bit. So I think Greg has put his finger on something kind of key here. We weren't able to relate to the comic book superheroes in the way that we were able to relate to these characters that had a definite dark side, but also a significant sympathetic quality.
So what then inspired you both, so many years after being first bitten by the genre bug, if you will, what inspired you then to take on writing your own Frankenstein tale?
I noticed this bizarre little costume continuity issue in the fourth Frankenstein film, The Ghost of Frankenstein, and the devil's advocate in me said, well, maybe that's something that should be addressed all these years later. Not that anyone really cares, but it might be fun to go there and explain, why is it that the monster is caked in dried sulfur in one scene? We fade out, we fade in, and he's clean, wearing another suit, and maybe 40 or 50 kilometers away. How did that happen? And then immediately I thought, well, this is a story that that Greg and I need to tell together if he's up for it. And so I tendered that invitation, and maybe Greg can pick it up there.
Yeah, and I was excited. I had this was my first time writing something with Paul, and we had worked on a lot of other projects together, but never a writing project like this. And so I was excited when he offered me the chance to co-write the story. And it was originally going to be a short story,
mm-hmm.
but it just kept growing and growing and taking on more of a life of its own. So
it broke out of the straps on the table and began lumbering forward and growing larger and larger. We had a monster on our hands, and how did we write it? Much the way that we're interacting right now, by phone and by email.
Yep.
He would write something and send it to me. I would kind of edit or tweak or polish it in some way and then add a little bit more and send it back to him. And he'd say, I liked it except for this part where you went too far. And I'd say, you're right. And I would bring it back. And so we would just sort of ping pong style trade segments of the story until we finally had this novella.
Now, there are four central characters in this novella. There's obviously Igor, spelled with a Y.
Yes.
There's the Frankenstein monster.
Yes.
There is Klaus, a tailor, and his young buxom daughter, Gretel.
Yeah.
Who did you base these characters on, and where did they come from in the Frankenstein canon?
Well, really, only two of them came directly from the canon, right?
Right.
The monster and Igor. Igor shows up in the third movie and kind of steals the show. The son of Frankenstein. And then he comes back for the fourth film, at the end of which his brain is transplanted into the monster's body. So technically, from that point on, the monster and Igor are one and the same, although the series kind of pretends that never happened at some point. So those two characters were well established for us by the movies that we had seen. Then Greg came up with the name Klaus Hauptschmidt, which seemed perfect for this immaculate, kind of anal-retentive tailor. And I imagined him as being played by David Hyde Pierce, who played Niles on the TV show Frasier, because who are we going to force to lock horns with Igor? His opposite. And so this guy is as kind of effete and fastidious as Igor is shaggy and scary. And it was great fun putting the two of them together and writing about their interaction. And then Gretel, she's kind of an archetypal Bavarian lass. There is a character very similar to her in The Ghost of Frankenstein, and we ended up turning the two of them into cousins. But Gretel is, I suppose, the love interest or the cheesecake in the story. There's got to be some at some point.
One thing I would mention is Paul and I talked about who we envisioned as the tailor, and we were originally kind of looking back at actors of the period of the 30s and 40s, and not really finding any. Paul kind of came up with the idea of David Hyde Pierce, and it was a good idea, but we weren't going there originally.
Right.
It was sort of it came to Paul.
And Gretel became more significant, I think, as we went on. I think she started as that archetype or even a stereotype, but by the end, we actually had some excerpts from her point of view, and I really like her. She's pretty brave. When her father's being menaced by the Frankenstein monster and orders her to run out, she runs toward him instead. He's kneeling on the floor, and she kneels with him in order to try and help him. So she may be cheesecake, but she's cheesecake with nerve.
Now, obviously, the story centers around, as you mentioned, Paul, filling in that gap of how the monster got this brand new suit, and he and Igor have traveled from one place to another.
One fictitious Bavarian town to another, yeah.
And so that's where this tailor comes in, who is pretty much ordered to make this monstrous suit for the monster. But along the way, along this journey, it's almost like a buddy tale between Igor and the monster. Tell me a little bit about what you based this friendship on.
And I'm glad you noticed that. And some of the reviews, we've had some real nice reviews over the past week, have noticed that despite its zaniness, there's this kind of wrenchingly sweet relationship between two of the principal characters. And it was present. It was present in the two movies in which they appear together, the son of Frankenstein and the ghost of Frankenstein. And then in some backstory in our novella, we see the moment where they met. This was never dramatized in the Universal films. It was kind of neat to be able to go back and do justice to Igor's backstory and how he met the monster. And the scene that Greg wrote for that was indeed wrenchingly sweet, where Igor could well die at any moment if not for the monster bringing some water to him and saying, "Friend, good." Greg, you want to pick it up?
Well, I'll say one thing. The third film in the series, Son of Frankenstein, it's the first film that the Igor character appears in. And there is a scene towards the end of the film where Wolf Frankenstein, the son of the original Dr. Henry Frankenstein, shoots Igor, puts a few bullets in him, and we believe he's dead. When the monster finds the dead Igor, his friend, he lets out this horrible wail of despair.
Yeah.
And that, to me, really summed up their relationship. I mean, it was dear friends, the two of them. And I really wanted to capture that in this novella.
And one of the paradoxes is we can do that. We can talk about this sweet friendship and relationship between two characters who are, at the end of the day, both pathological killers. You know, but to make them relatable, as the films did to some extent, and get inside their minds. Each of them is a point of view character in the novel, principally Igor. He's the main one. But we do go into the monster's mind from time to time, too, what there is of it, and into Klaus's a fair amount, and occasionally into Gretel's. So it's sort of a chamber play, and we've got these four principal characters, and we let them take turns guiding the reader through.
Well, let me say, Greg Starrett and Paul McComas, thank you both so much for coming in and telling us about Fit for a Frankenstein.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you for having us.
A pleasure.
Milwaukee native Paul McComas and Greg Starrett are the authors of the new novella Fit for a Frankenstein, published by Walkabout Publishing. McComas's next novel, Logan's Journey, is co-authored with Logan's Run author William F. Nolan, set to be released in 2014. That's Frankenstein for Thanks for Listening Today. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Hope you can do the Monster Mash with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. You can also listen online at your leisure. Check out WUWM.com and find out how to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks again for listening to a Halloween edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the MASH.
It's now the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the MASH.